Good evening, everybody, and welcome tonight. I'm Lyndall Johnson, one of the Sims local Dharma leaders, and I'm filling in for Rodney on this last evening before he is back with us next week. And the title of my talk tonight is Gifts of Anatta. And anatta, of course, is the Pali word for not self. And I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous about choosing this as my topic tonight, since it really is kind of one of those big guns of Buddhism. And so I had a little bit of worry, you know, do I really understand this deeply enough to talk about it, to say something that's going to be really helpful and not too superficial, to make sure I don't say something that is even wrong. But, and, you know, seeing as it's April Fool's Day, too, somehow as I was getting ready for this, I couldn't help but remember that old saying about, you know, how fools rush in where angels fear to tread. But as I thought about this a little bit more, I realized that a lot of these doubts and fears that I was having are just the same doubts and fears that we all have. Where we feel like, you know, we really don't understand, we really don't know what we're doing, that keep us so focused on what we don't understand and that what we don't get in our practice and what we feel that we aren't doing right, that we don't always recognize the wisdom that we really do have. So in that spirit, I offer this talk, and I think that that theme will sort of run through it, is sometimes we actually know more than we realize we know. But apart from any of these doubts or fears or anything like that I might have about this topic, I was drawn to it also because it fits really nicely with some of the themes that we have been considering over the past month. And certainly Tim and Carrie have both touched on it. If we think about false premises, which was the title of Tim's talk, what more persistent false premise do we operate under than that one of a solid separate self and of that tendency to identify our experiences, our thoughts, as being me, mine? And if we think about Carrie's talk, Living the Question, isn't this question of who I really am, what I really am, one of the central questions of our practice? And then also in the story that Carrie shared with us in her talk of Chiono's No Water, No Moon, Chiono's enlightenment poem was really a beautiful expression of her realization of anatta, and it was kind of a koan for me that sort of has stayed with me during the week and kept coming up as I was preparing this talk. Just for those of you who maybe weren't here or have forgotten, I'll just recite this poem once more. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. So, seeing as this theme has been threading its way through the talks of the past month, I thought it was appropriate to continue with the topic. Now, anatta, or not self, is probably one of the more perplexing and challenging ideas in Buddhism for those who are at the start of their practice. And I think maybe I shouldn't say just at the start. It can be pretty perplexing and challenging all through our practice in some ways. I think we really have some sense of some of these other concepts. We have a sense of the truth of dukkha or suffering in that we realize that aging, sickness, and death are things that really do happen to all of us. And we also realize, well, we have many beautiful experiences in life. There's also a lot that really isn't very satisfying, and the good and happy things, while they're wonderful, while they last, they don't last forever. So we kind of understand that. We also have some intuitive sense about impermanence, that things really do change, that we live in a world that is unstable. And the recent mudslide in Oso was really a tragic and sobering reminder of that, that, you know, we really don't always know what may happen from one moment to the next. Now, of course, really accepting these truths on a really deep level and living in accordance with them is another matter. That can be much more challenging and much more frightening and difficult, but I think at least they make some, you know, intuitive sense to us. Now, anatta, on the other hand, or not self, really isn't all that intuitive, and it can seem like it's very much in contrast to our day-to-day experience. You know, typically we really certainly feel a very solid sense of identity and of self, and the idea that this isn't really the reality can seem quite strange, quite confusing, even frightening. Intellectually, we might have our own way of coming to a sort of acceptance of this idea that the self, or what we think of as me, isn't quite the single and solid entity that we imagine it to be. And certainly we know from science that the body, just the body itself, is not a single solid thing, but a collection of many, many cells, all of which have their own DNA, their own nuclei, their own cycle of life and death, you know, all these little separate things. So in that sense, the body is definitely an aggregate of many of these parts that are living out their own existence. And we also know that our thoughts and emotions, too, are based in a very, very complex processes that involve the body and include, you know, complex nervous impulses, influences of hormones, many, many things going on. But this is something that, you know, intellectually we might understand, and on a theoretical level we may accept, but knowing it in that way isn't it exactly the same thing as something that touches us personally. I also suspect that when most of us start our meditation practice, we aren't, you know, just going in there with this burning desire to understand the truth of not self. In fact, we may not even have a clue what that even has to do with anything. And I know when I started my practice, I certainly didn't feel, you know, that way, that this was what the focus was. I was attracted to the quietness, to the peacefulness, you know, the feeling of being connected more fully with my present experience, so that I actually could appreciate better the feeling of the wind, the sight of the flowers, beautiful sounds of birds, things like that, actually be present for these things. And the idea of anatta or not self was something that seemed really far away and kind of strange and enigmatic, something my teachers talked about and I didn't understand, and I knew I really didn't understand, and I don't know if I was even really that eager to understand, to be absolutely truthful. It felt like some sort of kind of mystical thing that was out there for special and enlightened people, and maybe someday I would get some idea of what this was about, but it certainly wasn't going to be any day soon, and I wasn't all that worried about it. So, you know, sort of peace and calm and, you know, those sort of things, that was just fine as far as I was concerned. And yet I think that even if we aren't looking for it, as we continue to practice, the truth of anatta has a way of finding us anyway. Because when you really look closely at the moment-to-moment experience of the body and the mind, it's there. It's seen, because it's part of the way things are. For many of us, an understanding of anatta comes through this gradual process of disassembling and breaking down of all those aggregate parts of what we call the self that happens when we do Vipassana meditation. It's, you know, that process where we start sitting here on our cushion, very solidly feeling like us, trying so hard to keep our minds from wandering and paying attention to the breath, you know, feeling very much like we're sitting here doing this thing, let's call meditation. But at some point, or gradually, that changes to something very, very different, where there is simply something more like thoughts, sensations, sounds, simply coming and going, arising and passing. And we would be very, very hard-pressed to really figure out who exactly or what exactly is doing the thinking, is doing the knowing. And it certainly doesn't feel much like that me that's sitting on the cushion trying so hard to keep the attention on the breath. Something very, very different. Of course, you know, this kind of understanding, you know, doesn't usually happen all at once. It often comes in bits and pieces with a lot of small tastes and small realizations. Sometimes this might be something to do with just our experience of the body itself, with it this changing from a sense of me sitting here in the body, knowing my body, to something that's much more fluid, waves of sensation, flow of energy that is much less feeling like me or mine. And so it can be with our thoughts too. For example, in my own experience, I remember one time when I was at Cloud Mountain on a retreat, and it wasn't, I guess I'd been practicing a couple of years. It wasn't, you know, a long time into my practice. And after breakfast, I went out walking, strolling along the road, and was in a, you know, pretty quiet state of mind, mostly, you know, just knowing the feeling of the body moving and the feeling of the cool morning air. When all of a sudden I became aware of my mind just throwing up all of this stuff. I mean, it was like just junk appearing in the mind, you know, all kinds of things, like song lyrics, bits of old memories, images that seemed like they were from dreams, just, I mean, God knows what, it was just junk, mind junk. And, you know, it wouldn't have been at all accurate to say that I was thinking about these things. I felt it was like I didn't really have anything to do with it all. It was, the mind was just spewing up junk. And it was really quite a kind of a shocking experience, really. And at that time, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it. I was like, oh my God, what is this thing? What's happening, you know? And I didn't quite, you know, I wasn't sort of thinking, oh, I'm experiencing not self, or I didn't know quite what I was experiencing. But one thing that it really did make me realize, without question, that my thoughts and I were not necessarily connected in quite the way that I had always assumed. And I think, you know, many of us have had experiences that are maybe not quite exactly like this, but something on this order. And they begin to sort of break down this assumption we have about what is me. Others may recognize anatta in a somewhat different way, sometimes sensing this truth through moving deeper and deeper into silence, deeper and deeper into a feeling of quietude, until finally reaching this very deep stillness, where it's no longer me experiencing stillness, but just stillness. Still others might sense it most clearly through a feeling of connection, through empathy, through recognizing our common humanity, through seeing that so much of what we experience really isn't about us as individuals, but about the human condition, about the way the mind works, about just simply being human. Or also maybe through a recognition of how closely we are connected, how much we influence each other through our thoughts, through our actions, in ways that, you know, often we don't really even appreciate, really don't understand at all. I remember reading in one of Virginia Woolf's books, I don't remember quite which one it was, it might have been Mrs. Dalloway, but there was this kind of, there's a stream of consciousness stuff, and I remember there was this description of a sort of conversation and thoughts of these people, and I think that one of the characters looking out the window and seeing this soldier after the First World War that had kind of shell shock, sort of wandering, and I think she was thinking some thoughts about it, and somehow she said or did some little tiny thing, and the other character picked up a thought that sort of was related but kind of different, and it sort of, there was this kind of, what everybody was thinking and saying little bits of was influencing what everybody else was saying and thinking little bits of in this way where you wouldn't think of that as Buddhism, but yet it was kind of a very interesting example of this connectivity. And so in that way, you know, we may appreciate a sense that we are not separate and we're part of this connected web. So there's no single way, there's no right way. And I think probably for most of us, our understanding of anatta is based on bits and pieces of all these ways that I mentioned, and maybe other ways as well. And as I said before, the understanding doesn't necessarily happen all at once. We may have a lot of small experiences that gradually chip away and chip away at our, you know, long-held assumptions and beliefs in a permanent and solid self until finally the weight of evidence just becomes too great and our views change. The old beliefs fall away. And sometimes that might happen in a very gradual way, so we don't even hardly realize it's occurring until we suddenly realize that we just don't see things the way we used to. Other times it may happen more, you know, more suddenly in the sense of Chiono's basket, as if the bottom just falls out. And the bottom falls out and we suddenly think, oh my God, you know, all that stuff my teachers have been saying all this time is really true. Ooh, what am I going to do now? And this time when the bottom falls out isn't necessarily a moment of great peace and joy. In fact, sometimes it's a moment of sheer terror, or at least of disorientation and confusion. And, you know, that's quite understandable because the mind is being confronted with a whole new way of seeing things that isn't that familiar and not that comfortable. Something, you know, we kind of sense finally really is true, but we haven't really integrated it. And yet, I think even in the midst of the fear and the confusion and the disorientation, new understanding is there, and the wisdom of that new understanding can really penetrates and can arise. Not too long ago, I was in a discussion group at one of our, you know, day-longs or non-residential retreats, and someone in this group mentioned being on a residential retreat a while ago and having had a very deep realization of impermanence, something that was made them feel almost as if the very ground they were standing on was slipping away. And they were talking about how, you know, even several months later, feelings of fear were there, feelings of confusion and disorientation. You know, they weren't comfortable with the experience. They weren't comfortable. And yet they also went on to say that not too long after they had been on this retreat, a friend of theirs died suddenly, And, you know, it was a real shock to everybody that knew this person. There was a lot of sadness. There was a lot of grief. But somehow in the middle of this grief, this wisdom came up, this thought arose, this understanding, you know, though, this is how life is. Things really can change in an instant. They do change in an instant. And the person that was relating this felt, you know, kind of almost a surprise, because it was if this wisdom was there, but they didn't even recognize yet that they truly knew this. And yet they did know it on a very deep level. So not that it changed in any way the fact that they were sad, the fact that they were grieving, but there was also this understanding and deep acceptance in the midst of that that came out of their earlier experience. And, you know, it just sort of arose without them even recognizing it was something that they knew. And I think it can be very much the same way with our understanding of anatta. We don't necessarily have to understand completely or know fully for that wisdom to penetrate and for it to change the way that we see the world. In 1 Corinthians, when he's describing the understanding that the early Christians have of Jesus in their current life as compared with what their understanding would be when they were united with him in heaven or at the second coming, however it was he was thinking of it at that time, the Apostle Paul says, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face." And although it's in, you know, a very different context, I feel as though those words, "now we see through a glass darkly," fit pretty well with the way that we often feel about our understanding of anatta. It's not a bad description. This sense that, you know, we do see, we do understand something, but it's imperfect. It's not complete. There's something more that we still have yet to understand. And I know I certainly feel that way, you know, knowing that I do understand some, and yet that there are deeper levels where that understanding really hasn't penetrated, you know, places where maybe my mind is still not ready to go yet, is still afraid of. Maybe because of fear or whatever reason. And yet even if it's perfect, there's still understanding. You know, even with the early Christians, even through a glass darkly, they could still see enough to profoundly change their lives. And I think that's really true for us too. Just seeing enough to bring us to the point where we really begin to question those false premises of ours. And we really begin to doubt our habitual worldview about who we are and what we are. Just to get to that point can really change our understanding of ourselves and of our world quite dramatically. And this change can really contribute in many different ways to our peace of mind, to our well-being, and also to the well-being of the people that we interact with. And so now I'd like to go on and talk a little bit about some of these ways in which this understanding of not-self, however imperfect it may be, can really benefit us. And these are what I've referred to in the title of the talk as the gifts of anatta. And to begin with, I think one of the gifts, somewhat paradoxically actually, is that a gift of understanding not self is a gift of self-acceptance. You know, it's often our default pattern to take everything that comes up in our minds really personally and to think that it's a sign of our goodness or our badness, whether we're valuable or whether we're unworthy, what kind of a person we are. And it's rather sad, too, that a lot of times that evaluation that we take from what we see that's in our minds and in our hearts is something negative. You know, we have this sense of, this is terrible, what's ever going on is all my fault, this shows what an awful person I am, this shows I'm defective, this shows there's something wrong with me. We can really get caught up in those kind of feelings. And I think this is something that has come up sometimes in our small discussion groups, how often we have that kind of feeling and think we're the only ones that have that kind of feeling. Kind of a strange thing. But when we begin to see for ourselves more about the way the mind functions, the way that it kind of does its own thing a lot of the time in spite of our efforts to control it, and the way that thoughts and emotions and images and so forth, you know, they just arise in the mind and they don't bother to ask our permission whether they're going to be there or not. They just come. And so we begin to really have some sense, you know, this isn't me or mine or what I am in the way that we maybe once thought that it was. But they seem a lot more like they really are natural phenomena that arise according to conditions. And truly, that they aren't so personal. And I say this not so personal, not in a way of being something that is cold or detached, but more in the sense that, you know, not being all just about us, all about us as individuals, but much more about being human. Much more about simply the way the human mind works. And when we can understand that, when we begin to see that, I think we can be much more at ease with ourselves. And we don't need to feel any longer as if every thought and emotion is a personal and permanent and often negative statement about us. You know, that idea just really doesn't make sense anymore. And when we begin to feel like that idea does not make sense anymore, this can free us from an enormous burden of self-criticism and self-hate that so often we carry around with us. And this is just a tremendous gift, a tremendous gift. I think also as we begin to see how thoughts and emotions come and go in the mind, you know, by themselves really, we're able to see more clearly that they're not permanent. That feeling sad doesn't make us a depressed person. Feeling angry doesn't make us a hostile person. And of course, you know, there's tendencies and impulses that arise that aren't so skillful, aren't so great. But there are also many tendencies and impulses that are kind and generous and loving. And so we do not have to feel like any of these really define us or make us any one thing. And I think as we begin to take what arises in our minds and hearts a little bit less personally, we're more able to accept and acknowledge all of what we think and feel. We have greater clarity and honesty because we don't need so much to conceal, to hide, or pretend to others or to ourselves. And I think that's very, very healthy and a very good thing. And we can begin to see what is difficult for us, not so much as a statement about what failures we are, but more, you know, as a reaction or a tendency that comes up in certain situations. And we don't have to feel like this is something that's so scary or something that's so condemning. It's more something, you know, we can look at it, maybe we can work with it, maybe we can understand how this happens and deal with it in a way so it doesn't cause us so much suffering and it doesn't cause us to act out in ways that cause other people to suffer too. And this certainly is really a great benefit in our day-to-day lives. And I think, too, with this acceptance of ourselves comes acceptance of others. Because when we begin to realize that we are not so solid and so unchanging, but more of a process, we see that others are the same way. And just as our behaviors come from causes and conditions that we don't always fully understand, so do theirs. Maybe there are many things that they are doing that they don't understand why they are doing. Maybe many things that they're doing that they're no happier with than we are with some of the behaviors that we have. And so, as we begin to understand that more fully, we might begin to notice that when we deal with people in our lives that may be kind of challenging or maybe kind of difficult, compassion begins to arise more often than judgment. Another gift that an understanding of anatta can bring is a lessening of our feelings of self-consciousness. As we believe less and less in the solidity of ourselves, we become less identified with our self-image. And so we're not so concerned about living up to some, you know, ideal of who we think we're supposed to be or that we feel our culture is telling us that we need to be. And in fact, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to think in quite that way or to build up any sort of ideal image of who we are, since we can kind of see the unreality of any image and how very fragile and how very temporary any sense of I am this really is. And I think having some appreciation of this can help us to move through our lives in a way that's more natural, so we can respond to what comes up during the day without worrying so much about exactly how we are appearing or whether we're fitting a certain mold that we ought to be conforming to, much more just simply doing what needs to be done. So, you know, if one day we're in some sort of very honored position addressing crowds of thousands, and the next day we're in the bathroom cleaning out the toilets, it's like, so what? You know, it's okay. It's all fine. There isn't a need to, you know, live up to a certain status or image. And with that, I think there's a natural humility that goes along with that. You know, if we're not so caught up in self-image and projecting a certain picture of ourselves, we don't get so caught up in pretensions or in building up or promoting a certain way that others might see us. You know, really, what is there to be pretentious about? So it's sort of a relief in that sense. An understanding of anatta can also, I think, contribute to our sense of compassion. And I've mentioned this a little earlier, that it can do this because it can help us to see more fully our connectedness and our common humanity. But I think that also this can be awakened just, you know, from the experience of really seeing deeply into this truth of anatta or any of the three characteristics, you know, also of dukkha or suffering or anicca or impermanence, on a deep level, as, you know, what happens to us as we practice. You know, because seeing these truths really deeply and clearly is pretty hard. They're a bit, you know, they're kind of disturbing. They're not our normal paradigm, and when we begin to get into touch with this, it really shakes our world. And even if there really isn't so much to fear, because of our ideas and because of our discomfort, there can be a lot of fear. And it's really tough to get through this without a sense of kindness and compassion and patience for ourselves. And I know, I think personally, I think the time when I really begin to appreciate the value of metta for myself and compassion for myself was when I was going through a period in my practice when there was really a lot of fear. And it was the metta that really got me through. You know, I just, when I was not able to stay steady with the fear itself. I think that can really, really help us. And we learn to appreciate that skillful means as something that can support us. And when we face our own fears and we awaken this sense of kindness to ourselves, when those fears arise, I think we understand that other people are facing these fears in just the same way. And so our compassion and our understanding for them also grows. And in, I think, what can be a very beautiful way. And so the very difficult part of facing some of these deep truths can also be a very great gift because it can help us, you know, really come in touch with our hearts. And I think the last thing that I would like to mention is that an understanding of anatta can be something that can really help to free us from that cycle of becoming that we talked about in all the whole series of dependent origination. Perhaps, you know, with a more imperfect understanding, maybe we're not freed completely, and maybe we're not freed at the deepest levels. But even so, if we just have even some sense of how fragile that image we call me can be, then the allure is just not so great, you know? And that tendency that we have to kind of sit there imagining the future, picturing this lovely time, and when, not just when all, you know, conditions are going to be wonderful, but I think also we could picture this wonderful me that's going to exist at this time when all conditions are wonderful. This perfect me, you know, that's totally virtuous or totally kind, or, you know, maybe on a more mundane level that has the perfect looking body or the perfect job or whatever. You know, it's, and we kind of have this sense of how wonderful I will be when everything comes to pass that I want to be. If we have even some understanding of the contingent nature of what we call ourselves, we kind of see, you know, that's kind of crazy, you know, to build up this thing. It's not going to last. It isn't even real. It's just an idea. And so we begin to not seek that so much, not aspire that so much. I mean, you know, really, what's the point? What's the point of putting so much emphasis on this thing that we may become when we realize on some level that it's really just a phenomenon that comes together and falls apart, that really is forming and dissolving in every second? You know, from that viewpoint, what is there to become? It's just nothingness. And so it kind of cuts through some of those habitual tendencies of mind. And I think, you know, we may not necessarily be able to articulate it. We may not really recognize it exactly within ourselves, but there's a way in which we're not drawn to some of our patterns of thought that used to have such a big hold on us. So this just touches on some of the gifts that even a partial and imperfect understanding of anatta can bring to our lives. And I'm sure that you have all experienced some of these kinds of gifts, some of these experiences. And as you reflect, you might understand, you might identify still more that I haven't even mentioned. this evening. So as we continue to practice and our understanding deepens what at first seems like a very strange, abstract, weird and mystical idea that we're kind of like, I don't even know if I want to have anything to do with that, in fact, is a reality that can bring some very practical and very healing benefits to our lives. So we may have a fair amount of time for questions, but I think that's okay. This sort of is wrapping up what I wanted to say. And so I'd like to close tonight by reciting once more Chiono's enlightenment poem. So this poem. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. And just so, when we're in the midst of the ever-changing, ever-flowing stream of life, that image that we call ourselves does not dwell, but breaks into a million pieces with the rushing water. Let's sit together for a few moments. Thank you all for coming tonight. And now I'd like to open up the floor for any questions you might have or comments you might have or anything you might like to share from your own experience. This is something that I'm not so totally familiar with. I think Carrie knows better, but I think in the Zen tradition, often when someone has a experience, a moment of realization or enlightenment, they respond with the spontaneous poem that captures their experience, and that certainly was the case for the poem that Carrie shared with us in her talk a couple weeks ago.
Draws me to want more.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that what you say is so true. She was mentioning how when we begin to have some of these experiences, what is the right attitude? You know, it's the sense that it's something that we cannot call up at will. And that's very true. You know, I think you just continue practicing and to continuing to be with whatever arises. And I think there's sort of a tendency to try to look for it. You know, there can be either sometimes if it's something, you know, very lovely and very pleasant, we can get this idea that, oh, this is what the practice is all about, and, you know, come to our sitting or whatever with this idea of wanting this to happen. But that's in its own lesson, because I think as we do this, after a while, we really recognize the suffering we're creating for ourselves by always being, you know, on the lookout for this thing and this dissatisfied because this special thing isn't happening. So finally, if we're wise, after beating our head against the wall enough, we'll go just sort of give up and say, well, what happens, happens. Maybe it will be beautiful. Maybe it will be painful. What happens, happens. And just be there for that. And that's really a lot of wisdom. And I think also, too, sometimes we can get a sense of, even if the experience isn't something we're necessarily exactly seeking, because it's a little bit too overwhelming and it's a little bit too frightening, there can be still be this sense of going, feeling like we still need to go looking for it, which I don't think it works very well. We may go looking, but when we find it, it is not going to appear in the way that we imagined when we're going to look. You know, it does, it comes when it comes. And that sometimes we may be spending a lot of time seeking some particular experience when what's really happening is, through all the confusion and fear, the wisdom is penetrating in ways that we can't even recognize. So it very much, we have to trust the process, and we can't expect it to go as we think it should go, or spend too much time worrying about seeking out a particular thing, because usually it isn't the way that we expect it to be. Yes?
In thinking about this matter of lack of self, of non-self, I keep coming up the history of the world, if people had this feeling of non-self, would we have all this development we have? Would we have the art that we have, the music, all of these things where people are creating these wonderful things? Would that happen without, if they were, had these feelings of non-self? I mean, I just keep coming up against that. And it's scary for myself, because my identity, a lot of my identity is tied up in what I do. And I think if I didn't do all that, I mean, it just seems like a dichotomy.
Well, I don't think the understanding of not self, I mean, it isn't exactly non-self in the sense that we don't exist at all, but sort of that we are not, what we think of as self is much more of an aggregate and a process than a permanent and unchanging thing. But I think that understanding doesn't have to mean that we wouldn't do anything, or that we wouldn't create anything. It might, in fact, in some ways, it might be even a somewhat beneficial in the sense that we might create less through a feeling of pushing forward our personality and ego and sort of allowing the muse to flow through, maybe. I know sometimes people that are artists talk about their creation not seeming to come from themselves personally, but sort of through tapping into a bigger reality or beauty. So I think it could mean that some of the motivation to do that's based on desire for status and recognition and personal gain would not be so great, but doing out of a sense of connecting with beauty or goodness or wholesomeness, that wouldn't have to change. Or interest or learning, that wouldn't have to change. So I hope that kind of helps some. I can sort of see how we can feel that if a lot of our motivation to do things really comes out of that personal identification, if that isn't there, why would we want to do anything? But I think as we understand more deeply, we will see that that doesn't have to be the case.
I think speaking to that a little bit, when I'm working, when I get out of my way, all of that ego is pushed aside. So much creativity comes out that doesn't come out of my
Yeah, well, I think just so was your statement. I think that's a very common experience that, you know, a lot of artists and creative people feel. And hearing that makes the idea of this seem a little bit less threatening and scary, too. Yeah, the comment was about a seeing a little girl in the store that was just, you know, walking along behind her mom, just singing and completely present, not worrying about what anyone might be thinking about her, just totally unself-conscious, and sort of seeing that as a kind of expression of the flavor of awakening or enlightenment, in that sense of not being concerned about one's projection or image, just simply present and connected with what is. And I, yeah. I think that's true, you know, in that that sense that there not being a sense of, oh, I'm being so mindful, or oh, I'm being so virtuous, or oh, I'm being so enlightened, you know, it just is, yeah, you know, the individual just isn't really thinking in that way. They're just going through life and responding to what happens and not really thinking in that way. So I think that it's kind of a nice, you know, a child like that may not be quite exactly, you know, but it's a nice image and a nice kind of way of thinking about, you know, this sort of unself-consciousness that isn't really worrying about me and how whatever I am, but is just present. So that's a nice image. Thank you. Yeah, I think I see what you're getting at. The comment was that in some sense we always are self and we always are here, so maybe the heart of it is more in unself-consciousness. And I think that is true in the sense that as we move through our daily life, yes, of course, we, you know, we have our sense of I am here in my body, and I'm, you know, doing the things that I do, and I have my family, and, you know, that certain level of identity. And so there's a part of it that, you know, we experience that, and yet there's a sense in which we experience it, but we also know that isn't the full story. And it isn't quite the way that we may have understood it before, as being quite so solid, quite so permanent. So there's, you know, this sense of understanding more about the aggregate and contingent nature of self. But in terms of behavior in the world, I think you're right that it may often appear very much as just a kind of presence and unself-consciousness. Uh-huh, up there.
Thank you.
That's happened to me often, too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comment is about, you know, the difference between, you know, an individual that is not self-conscious because they're not, you know, concerned about the projections of self versus someone that's unself-conscious because they're out of touch with reality. And, you know, I think, you know, when we're talking about the image of the child, it isn't necessarily so much that particular child themselves, with their unself-consciousness, really embodies the true depths of understanding of anatta and the unself-consciousness that comes from that kind of understanding. And simply being not self-conscious doesn't necessarily mean there's a lot of wisdom or understanding there. But I think that having that understanding does bring us to a point where we're less obsessed with self-image. So yes, certainly you need to make some, you know, distinctions there. Yes. Well, that is true. You know, maybe it would be a better world if we spent a little bit more time singing to the salmon. Maybe they'd be a little bit healthier. So I think, you know, that's kind of a funny point in that, you know, it doesn't hurt to be maybe a little bit silly when we're being not so self-conscious. And I think it's getting time for maybe good to wrap up now because we do have some announcements.